Well, I'm still in the world that you just presented to us, John. And since you didn't get taken away with a white sheet over your face by an ambulance, I'm wondering how it is that you developed the stupid, insensitive doggedness to find destiny as a writer, and how you made your way from what seemed like a terrifying impasse to the life of a writer.
With the chronology, Dusklands came out in 1974. That was my first published fiction. We've been talking about events of 63, 64. So there was another 10 years of dodging around and evading destiny.
How did you come to thaw the state of cold, frozen inability to risk failure? Was it finally a matter of persisting, reaching a further state of intolerability? What made the threshold crossable as you gradually began to write? And I suppose I could attach to that the question of whether it involved adjusting your sense of wanting to write as a poet, which I was fascinated to learn about, adjusting from there to making sentences as a fiction writer or as a novelist.
I gave up on poetry. I gave up on poetry in the 1960s, but didn't cease to read it. And it's interesting, people always assume that because you write novels, you like to read novels. I, in fact, write novels, but much prefer to read poetry.
And were there poets that were particularly important in those years that may have had an impact in terms of your gradually moving towards writing and taking up the life of an artist after all?
Well, I was very heavily under the influence in my teens and early 20s of first T.S. Eliot, but then more substantially Ezra Pound. And then later of German poetry, of Rilke in particular.
Yes. Well, this couldn't have been easy, given that your people that you were reading were of such enormous achievement and caliber. So to make those first ventures into writing must have been, in a way, daunting, particularly daunting. And
I don't think one should try to make of indecisiveness and lack of willpower anything so large as daunting.
I shall remember that. Well, perhaps you could tell us a little of the first steps as you moved towards writing what became Dusklands. I mean, what were the circumstances and what gave rise to your choice of the material? Presumably you'd not been back in South Africa, and yet this is a book which has a life both within the United States and South Africa. And I'm curious as to its genesis.
Its genesis was very tortuous. I started reading the writings of early travelers in Southern Africa in the British Museum in the early 1960s. Finding it fascinating, finding that those writings fascinating in themselves, and had the idea of writing a spoof travel book from the early 19th century myself. It didn't seem to me all that difficult if one actually knew the terrain.
Yes.
But then that got sidetracked. I was a graduate student for a long time, and it was turned out to be impossible to devote oneself to study and at the same time work on fiction. I mean, to cut a long story short, you know, short, I set 30 as a deadline. If I hadn't begun to write by the age of 30, I would never write. And so the 1st of January 1970, I sat down and started to write Das Lands. And perhaps you can move on from there now.
Sure. Well, I think we can, yes. To return to the work that you're actually just completing now, this sequel to Boyhood, obviously certain writers are more important than others at certain times in one's writing life. And having been working in this field of memoir and autobiography, have there been particular writers that have been important to your project? Or do you feel yourself like one of those pioneers going out into forsaken country? I mean, I can imagine Proust, or perhaps given the vein of what you were reading, Kafka, even Philip Larkin, but it's a long way from Cape Town to Paris or Prague. And so who's important to you now?
Well, there are ways of being important. I think, you know, when one is younger, one is absolutely invaded by other writers and
yes.
one falls utterly under their sway. And one writes as if possessed by them, in fact, in a derivative way, but in a way that is important for one's formation.
Yes.
I think later on, the ability of other writers to actually take one over in that way wanes, and that's also probably a good thing in its way, I think. You know, for a writer in his middle years still to be under the influence of someone, some dead master, is suspect.
Yeah.
I began Boyhood in the 1990s when I was already in my, what was it, 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't really, you know, although I certainly read, for example, Wordsworth, read The Prelude with new eyes, having worked on Boyhood. I can't say that Wordsworth, for instance, is behind Boyhood in any way.
Yes. I can imagine him being there in the sense of that part, he says, fostered alike by beauty and by fear.
Yes.
And it does seem in Boyhood and again now, that the fostering possibility of fear is has been quite productive in your work and in your experience of what you write about. So that Wordsworth does ring a bell for me, certainly going back to Augustine and Rousseau and the sense of revealing an inner life that would otherwise have been withheld, kept secret, perhaps shameful in certain ways. Those seem to be strong figures in the background, perhaps a deep background. And in fact, that leads me to ask whether, since terms like shame and secrecy in Boyhood were so prominent, and since the predicament of the person with your own name and date of birth in the computer industry also seemed to carry the potential for kinds of shame, for certainly deep misgivings about working for powers that one didn't quite endorse, for being in a state of secrecy, in fact, under surveillance. There do seem to be certain possible threads, and so I'm wondering if any of this is worth our exploring together for a moment.
Probably not in the time we have at our disposal, but...
Why am I surprised? Yeah.
But a lot of the late 20th century does seem to have been scripted by Franz Kafka, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. Well, when you describe the anonymity of the brick row houses, the fear of being assimilated into a large mass, the intensely regimented work within cubicles, and the hollowing out of the self, it did bring Kafka to mind. But with it, as I was listening to you, came also the extraordinary powers of detached, meticulous observation. And those are qualities that I think have carried forward in your work. And so perhaps we could talk about Kafka for a moment. And if that's agreeable with you.
Yeah,
sure. Yeah.
No, I
mean, perhaps both in the fiction and...
Yeah. No, I want to distinguish two ways of two senses of Kafka the master. One, the minor sense, you know, in which he might be a literary influence on a particular writer, for instance, myself.
Yeah.
The other way, the uncanny way in which Kafka is prophetic of the lives at least some of us lead or have led. And that's a much more important sense in which he is a master.
Yes. Have there been ways in which you've recognized moments in your life or in your writing life by being able to refer to Kafka and acting in ways that avoid the kind of absorption into what looks like a cul-de-sac? By his power, by his example. In other words, has he been able to teach one in this more profound sense that you're describing as the secondary sense?
I don't have an answer to that. You know, there are. You know this yourself, mm-hmm. Clearly. There's a level of. Motivation within oneself that not only is difficult to scrutinize, but that it probably does one no practical good to scrutinize as a writer.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the deeper influence of Kafka's world, for example, on mine, it probably wouldn't do me any good to get a clear answer to that.
Yes.
Clarity being like this kind of blinding light in which it's impossible to work anymore.
Yes. Well, from what you read, with your careful distinction between either or on the one hand and or on the other, I'm willing to feel the weight of that response in terms of its atmospheric inclusiveness rather than its choosing with precision to go down that road. Perhaps I can change direction a little here and ask you the following question, which is about setting. And it seems to me clear that regardless of the actual setting of your novels, South Africa is naturally at the core of much of your work. And you now live and teach substantially out of South Africa. And of course the core is largely portable, it's internalized, perhaps unavailable. But is its centrality changing its nature for you recently, partly in the wake of, let's say, changes in South Africa in the last decade, partly as a consequence of your increased geographical distance? In other words, does that core feel as if it's operating differently in your writing?
No, I don't think so. I think the core of South Africa for me is belongs to my childhood. I've never acculturated elsewhere. I think the deep roots in landscape, in particular, belong to early years, and that's not uncommon.
No, it's not uncommon. The question is, whether it belonging in those early years has a radioactive life that continues to affect every year that follows, or whether it becomes something that recedes or is eclipsed, so that one is having to draw on other motive grounds.
I think there are writers who are able to draw fairly inexhaustibly from their childhood. I think I've reached the end of that.
Beyond questions of mere landscape.
Well, there's no mere landscape.
All right, there's no mere landscape. What do you mean there's no mere landscape?
There is no landscape that is mere landscape when we're talking about landscape as a formative influence.
Do you mean by that, and this would lead to where I was hoping to go, that a terrain is always a combination of certain physical features, but then of social, historical, political powers? Is that one of the senses that you mean when you say there's never just merely landscape?
No, I meant it really quite specifically. A power of attachment to a particular region, particular places. A drawing almost of vital force from it.
Yes.
Which I see as, when I talk of that as landscape, I really do mean, the physical nurturing earth, not these society that erects itself on it.
Yeah, and yet in Life and Times of Michael Kay, clearly the land is a crucial ingredient of the novel and of what occurs there. And even in the most recent novel, Disgrace, the question of the land, the farm, what it can, what it cannot yield, what kinds of dilemmas it provokes, these are important. So it's not as if it's not continuing to exercise the kind of force in your writing.
There is a movement, though, and the crucial question is over ownership. Most importantly, over the question of what a right relationship with the landscape should be.
Yes.
Whether ownership, which is the form, the most the readiest form of a right relationship that occurs to us in the Western legal tradition, is actually ethically the right relationship.
Yes.
And therefore, how it is possible to have right relations with a land that you don't own.
It strikes an enormous chord with me in my own relation to South African landscape and the sense of never having a legitimate relation to it. But I suppose what that raises, and it does seem to be an issue in Disgrace, the question of ownership and of yielding ownership, is, are we speaking of a particularly South African situation there, or can one think more globally in terms of these issues?
I would prefer to think more globally.
Yeah.
But one can't write a sort of globally set novel.
Yeah.
It has to be somewhere.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's what had provoked this question of setting, and whether now moving away, perhaps, is going to complicate your sense of setting.
I have no doubt it will. No doubt.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thinking of the very particular setting of page by page, the space that one creates as one writes a novel, and it's not impossible, perhaps you have a thought on this, that the dilemma of not being able to come into a right relationship with the literal land provokes an attempt to enter into relationship with this other domain, which is one that you are creating, farming in a sense, the blank page. And that becomes a crucial lure, the possibility of entering into a right relationship with something which one has made honestly, worked for, and so on. But where that's leading me is to say that I'm interested in the degree to which you are a master formalist. And I'd like that to be addressed partly as a way of allowing you to speak from the inside of your work rather than as critics would from the outside. There's a memorable scene of you as a boy, and this comes in your essay, What is a Classic?, which is actually between boyhood and the period that you begin here, of being arrested, breathtaken, by hearing Bach's well-tempered clavier emerging from a neighbor's window while you were in a garden in South Africa. And you beautifully capture the absolute quality of the almost mathematical beauty of that music and your sense of it being a classic, of it having an autonomy, of having it work through beautifully exposition and complication and resolution. And your own work seems to have these characteristics of classical proportion, a very carefully achieved structure and style, from individual sentences to paragraphs to entire chapters. And I'm wondering if you can speak about what technique means to you as a writer and what form allows you as a writer, even as it engages ethical and political issues.
Well, again, you know, we don't have a lot of time.
I know.
I have an image of Bach, I mean, Bach the man, which I like to contrast with the image I have of Beethoven.
Yes.
Beethoven to me is very much as in that famous painting of him, in which he is sitting, gazing up somewhere there with his hair all around the place, and the music is flowing into him and presumably flowing out of him, and he is by himself. He is rapt, and he is the epitome of the genius.
Yes.
The picture I have of Bach is of a man sitting next to me at a keyboard, and he says, "Let's try doing it this way," and then he does it this way. He says, "Now let's try doing it that way," and then he does it that way. And in this image, you know, I'm a child. He's the teacher.
Yes.
So he's teaching me these ways of doing it. But the thing that makes him special is that every time he does it, there is a mysterious moment in the improvisation that he produces. There's a mysterious moment at which he leaves you. He leaves you behind. He leaves your powers to follow him, to imitate him, to do what he's doing behind. And that power to quite effortlessly and without any notice to leave you behind seems to me a counter power to the power of romantic genius epitomized in Beethoven. It is what is mysterious about the classic, about about classical composition. I like to think of myself as, you know, the one who sits beside Bach at the keyboard, rather than the one who listens to Beethoven.
Yes, that's a magnificent answer and image. And I suppose the question is, has one been brought into a state of consciousness while he was sitting with you that allows you to pursue while alone that improvisatory movement that is at once somehow not dependent on romantic afflatus and yet has within it the right combination of liberty and law? I mean, are those circumstances that you encounter as you write?
No doubt, but self-consciousness is crippling at that moment. It really is best to cultivate a kind of ignorance or deafness to self-consciousness.
Your work seems to have so much precision, an almost autonomous set of imperatives that is designing it, and yet it's also unpredictable and apparently improvised. And now with this image of Bach, it does definitely lend an acoustic as well as a very fertile background to the work. I see we're coming to a close, so perhaps this should be the last question. And that would be that perhaps also a way of asking about current projects, because perhaps you're thinking of fiction again alongside these memoirs. But you've said that one of the great human tasks, especially for writers, is to imagine the unimaginable. And given these times and everywhere on the planet now, what does that mean now for a writer? What is the unimaginable? How do you bring it into that place that can exert pressure on your consciousness, the unimaginable? Is it a matter of waiting as for destiny, or is it a matter of sitting at the keyboard?
Well, the answer is it's a matter of sitting at the keyboard.
Right.
Also, you know, plainly, if there were a prescription for how to imagine the unimaginable, we'd all be doing it.
Yeah, I didn't mean a prescription. I suppose I meant, what does the unimaginable feel like? Or is it not even possible to feel it until it is present? I mean, perhaps this is just too far out of a question.
Yeah. Surely what characterizes the unimaginable is that you can't even imagine it negatively.
Well, I would say that one can feel its draw, its pull, it's a kind of suction out there. And it's what keeps us from sitting comfortably in the chair. It's what keeps us sort of looking over our shoulders or into the back of our heads. But it's got to exert some sort of magnetic field.
Yes.
And it's not a mere absence. But perhaps you disagree.
Well, it might be a mere absence.
Mm-hmm.
One has to entertain that devastating possibility too.
Yes. Well, perhaps that's the devastating possibility on which we should close, in which we are struggling in the presence rather the absence of the unimaginable. Thank you, John.